Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. And on the show today, we're beginning by talking about the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin. We'll take a look at their upcoming field trips, this year's Birdathon, and talk with our guest, David Kletter. He is Executive Director of the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. Have you ever been part of one of the foundation's trips? They're really cool. What'd you take away from the experience? And maybe have some questions about the work of the Natural Resources Foundation. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. David Kletter, welcome. Good to have you back.
Thank you, Larry. Nice to be here.
Let's begin by talking about the mission of the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin.
Sure. Well, the mission of the Natural Resources Foundation is to protect the lands, waters, and wildlife of the state of Wisconsin. And we do that by providing funding, leading partnerships, and connecting all people with nature. So, you know, the foundation was founded as a friends group to the Wisconsin DNR in about 1986. And to a great extent, we still serve in that capacity. So we're really focused on public lands and engaging people in, you know, all the great work and opportunities out there, conservation, environmental education, both.
Yeah, just thinking about it, have you got some projects that in your mind really were great and successful? I know there have been a lot of them, but...
Yeah, well, you know, going back, you know, to the early days of the foundation, we were involved in the trumpeter swan reintroduction, the whooping crane reintroduction. So, you know, helping, partnering with International Crane Foundation and the DNR on many of these projects over the years. I think, you know, more recently, in fact, I served with the foundation between 2004 and 2010. And during that period, we were really ramping up our support of state natural areas throughout the state. And we still do that work. So state natural areas are the highest quality natural resource areas in the state of Wisconsin. They protect, you know, rare and threatened and endangered species and habitats. And so over the years, that has really continued to be a big focus of ours. So we, to this day, are really investing in SNAs throughout the state of Wisconsin.
Yeah, it's nice to have that relationship with the DNR too, I think.
It is. I mean, you know, the resource experts there, you know, are second to none. I mean, they're some of the best in the country. And of course, you know, the natural resources here in the state of Wisconsin, in my opinion, are pretty much second to none. So it's thrilling and kind of an honor to work with the foundation and DNR and our other state partners and land trusts and environmental educators around the state. So it's been a pleasure.
Well, these field trips are great, and you've been doing them for, what, 30 years or so. What do you hope attendees take away from these experiences each year?
Yeah, well, the program started in 1993. So Barbar is a longtime colleague and friend of mine, both at the foundation and Driftless Area Land Conservancy, where I formerly worked. Started this program. Soon thereafter, hired Christine Tanzer, who is still our program field trip director after all these years. You know, the original program really was to get folks involved and get them out into nature. You know, our tagline currently is explore, love, and protect. And so I think for years we've had this you know, realization that, well, you know, before folks can be engaged in the protection and stewardship of our lands, waters, and wildlife, they need to know it and understand it and explore it and develop a relationship with it, you know, a love or a passion for it or a land ethic. So that's really why this program was started. And then I think over the years too, of course, as you know, and I do both, and many of the listeners do too, is that, you know, there are the social, psychological, emotional benefits of just being out in nature. So I think I was going to say a secondary, tertiary. It's a primary reason too of why we love to get people out into nature.
I kind of like, you were talking before the show started about taking your own kids,
yeah,
on these trips, and I think the family aspect of this is really cool.
Yeah, you know, and that's something that I think we're really interested in growing. You know, currently of our, we have 275 unique field trips on an annual basis, engaging about 5,000 people. We have repeat trips that I think by the end of the year, there'll be about 317. Of those, about 67, almost 70, are family-friendly trips. And yeah, we're really trying to engage kids, whether it's, you know, your kids or your grandkids. Because, you know, particularly those ages 6 to 11, you know, if we can get kids really engaged in the outdoors, like me, you know, you kind of imprint on that stuff. And that's really important for developing that lifelong love and ethic.
Yeah. I was thinking about my own daughter, Emily. I mean, she's was exposed early and often, and mm-hmm. now she's majoring in marine biology in college.
Awesome.
And I certainly agree with what you said. Lots of opportunities to participate, obviously, in one of these trips this year. Let's talk about some of the adventures. What kind of adventures have you planned?
Yeah, I mean,
there's topic areas, you know. And I looked, oh God, there's a dozen topic areas, roughly. Everything from birding to biking to art, fish, mammals,
geology, train rides through Tiffany Bottoms in the Lower Chip, and yeah, I mean, it's really fantastic. And I think, again, Christine Tanzer and Kim Kreidinger, who are, you know, leading and developing this program, have just done a fantastic job. And yeah, I mean, amphibians and reptiles, archaeology, history, art photography, birding, biking, boats, butterflies, citizen science, climate resilience work, edible plants. I mean, these field trips really are incredibly varied. And, you know, I had to bring my list here because it's so overwhelming, the number of field trips we have going. But, you know, sturgeon banding and banding kestrels and, you know, hikes through exploring old growth forests. We have forest bathing, you know, you name it. It's really a great program.
So you take something like sturgeon tagging.
Mm-hmm.
What might that look like? I mean, you're not going out there by yourself and somebody says, well, go catch a sturgeon and tag it.
No, these are and I've not been on this one, but I want to get on this one. But no, DNR biologists would lead this. And this is, you know, part of a study, right? So they will, I think, electroshock for sturgeon, and mm-hmm. that kind of brings them up to the surface. They net them. They'll bring them on board. They'll tag a fin. You know, they even allow people to hold the sturgeon, and some of these things are, you know, 60 pounds or bigger. And then they'll release them back into the water, obviously. But that is one that I definitely want to get on, and I've been wanting to do that for years. But even EDs of the organization that runs the program don't get on all these trips. So
and the trips located in a lot of areas. I mean, no matter where you are in the state?
Pretty much, yeah. Over the years, and I think there have been, we've engaged, I think, 74,000 people since the beginning of this program in these field trips. I think 3,800 unique field trips in every county. We're not hitting every county every year, but boy, pretty darn close. So yeah, it's certainly in every ecoregion, you know, throughout the state, there'll be multiple opportunities.
David Clutter, Executive Director of the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin, our guest today. As we're talking right now, we've been talking about the trips, but questions for him about the trips or maybe about the foundation, give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address ideas@WPR.org. I'd love to hear if you've been on one of those and what your experience was like. So that'd be a good thing to talk about as well. Well, I'm taking a look at these categories, and you just went through them. How does a person decide which category you fall in?
Let's yeah.
Put
well,
it that way.
Well, there, the field trip guidebook, which comes out. So first of all, if you'd like to participate in our field trips, you do have to become a member. Mm-hmm. And, you know, generally we're very loose in how we define membership. You know, if you give a gift to the foundation, you become a member. We do have membership levels, however. Our lowest membership level is $35, but we're if you give $20 and, you know, you're a member, you're fine. So we do require membership. When you are a member of the organization, we mail you the field trip guidebook. And the field trip guidebook really has a listing of every single field trip, photographs, descriptions of every trip. And you can be, you know, if you're interested, for instance, in a canoe trip or a kayak trip in Lake Superior, you know, you can look at the canoe kayak sections. And those will be color-coded. If you're interested in looking at prairies or grassland birds, those will be color-coded in the field trip guidebook. So you can look that way as well. So we also have an online option, which is a little more searchable too, and we're developing over time. So if you, you know, in time, our hope is, you know, if you want to search by date, you know, field trips, if you're having guests coming in, you know, then you might be able to search by date. So that's something we're working on. So right now we have the field trip guidebook and some online options for how you can search for these field trips.
Gee, I like that idea of searching by date. If you're having people coming to visit,
right?
What a great way to, great opportunity to kind of show them a little of Wisconsin.
Right, for sure.
And what it's about. And we do have a link to a link to that guide on our program notes.
Good. So, and you can certainly search by date in the guidebook as well. Yep.
Ideas at WPR.org/Larry under today's date. You can get that link to under our program notes. Well, the field trips, you mentioned DNR was involved, but who leads, generally speaking? Mm-hmm. Well, that can't be all DNR people.
No. DNR lead a good number of these trips, and we're grateful for our partnership with DNR because it's wonderful to have some of the top ecologists and biologists in the state of Wisconsin leading these trips. And, you know, it gives DNR an opportunity to show folks the good work that they're doing as well, which is great. But we have ecologists and, from nonprofit organizations, from land trusts. We've partnered with, you know, the Crane Foundation, of course, the Nature Conservancy, the different land trusts, environmental education centers, nature centers throughout the state. Even private landowners, we've had lead trips to talk about, you know, what private landowners are doing on their land to protect biodiversity over time. So it really spans a broad array of folks, geologists, archaeologists. So a lot of these might be with private organizations as well.
So, and there's a cost associated, I imagine it varies.
It does, yeah. Yeah, generally speaking, you know, it's about $18 a field trip. I think on average, about $25 a field trip. But we do have fundraiser field trips too, you know, where we're trying to, for instance, if we're partnering with another nonprofit that's a banding station, we might have a fundraiser field trip where the proceeds would go to the banding station to support their work. It does kind of span, but yeah, generally speaking, you know, in that $20-$25 area is about the price of a field trip. Mm-hmm. So we think they're pretty reasonably priced, and you know, we want to keep the price, you know, down. So, you know, we are providing equitable opportunities for most people, all people.
Yeah. And these aren't just $25, you might be spending 4 or 5 hours or more.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Over the course of
half a day, generally, yeah.
David Klutter, our guest today, Executive Director of the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin, and he's our guest, and I hope you'll join in. Again, the number's 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Trina LaSousa, our engineer today, Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with David Klutter, Executive Director of the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin. We're talking about the host of trips that the foundation develops each year and a broad range of topics and areas, you know, everything from biking to geology to boat rides to paddle trips to citizen science projects, all there for you to sign into and participate in. I hope you'll join in. Maybe you participated in one of these trips. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. David, you have a number of virtual field trips on your website, if I'm not mistaken. Talk about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, the virtual field trips came about during the pandemic, of course.
Yeah.
Not surprisingly.
Yeah.
Right. But, you know, we found, too, though, that there are a lot of people that for whatever reason, they may not be able to get out on a field trip. So the virtual field trip is a great, great option. We, again, developed these during the pandemic and post them online. And we still have some of the great, you know, biologists and ecologists and, you know, geologists leading these field trips. If folks go to our website, they're able to look at some of the past field trips that we've been doing. I think that's something, too, that, you know, virtual field trips, you know, we'd love to build out over time. You know, as a nonprofit, a relatively small nonprofit, there's only so much time and capacity. But it does lead me to, think about, too, the accessibility issue. And sometimes accessibility is a boundary creates difficulty for some folks to get out and about. But we are partnering with Accessibility Wisconsin as part of our field trip programs to provide opportunities for folks who may have some disability challenges. And so we have outdoor wheelchairs that AAW provides, which is fantastic. And I think we have about 25 trips this year that have that, the outdoor wheelchair as an option. So anyone can use those, which is really great. And we'd love to continue building our partnership with Accessibility Wisconsin over time and providing more opportunities on a greater number of field trips.
Yeah, those wheelchairs are...
They're cool.
Yeah, they don't look like a just sort of a regular.
No, they're a tracked vehicle. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's nice, too, because even in, you know, a little bit more sensitive areas, the tracks sort of spread out the weight. And so they're, you know, just distributing that weight among the track. So they're not terribly invasive, which is good.
Which reminds me, how do you, let's say somebody is worried about, well, am I going to be mobile enough to do this with all of these various things? You must have a way to kind of code that.
We do. And this is something that I think Christine has developed over the years. But, yeah, some of these trips, boy, they can be a challenge. Thomas Meyer, a good friend and colleague, longtime DNR employee, leads a trip in the Dells generally, and it's a march. And it's great. I love it. It's great. But it is a bit of a march. The terrain is really tough. You know, you're hanging on to a rope while you're, you know, prancing along the river on rock. It's very challenging. So what Christine has developed over the years is basically difficulty ratings for each of our field trips. So we have from, you know, extremely difficult all the way down to, you know, accessible with a outdoor wheelchair and everything in between. And the outdoor wheelchairs, too, you know, can you know, do quite a bit. So they can range pretty broadly on some of the terrains.
Yeah, I would think so. Linda emailed. She's been on a number of them over the years, including sturgeon tagging,
right,
eagle banding, kestrel banding, Voyager canoeing, elk calf monitoring, and many more. You do an outstanding job of providing wonderful opportunities to explore all of Wisconsin's outdoors and to experience it up close and personal. So Linda highly recommends these trips.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Linda. Yeah, they are great. And I just went on the kestrel banding. I took my kids to that last year, and kestrels are my son's favorite birds. So he was just over the moon. Yeah, it's good stuff.
Thank you, Linda. The Wayfarers Group.
Mm-hmm.
What's the Wayfarers Group? Talk about the Wayfarers Group.
Yeah, Wayfarers, that's a group of young people, and we're trying to really do a better job of engaging young people in our mission. And the Wayfarers are sort of, you know, folks that we know have an ethic just based on sort of research out there. I think they care about the environment, and we're just trying to do our best to engage them. So we created our Wayfarers group, which really engages these sort of young people and, you know, 20-somethings generally in our work. And so there'll be special field trips or opportunities to get involved with Wayfarers. They do all sorts of, you know, fun and engaging trips right now, mainly around southern Wisconsin. But it's just been a really great way of getting young people involved in our mission.
Yeah. And how do they get involved in that?
Well, they can reach out to Somi Gottamidi on our team, runs the Wayfarers program and also runs our Birdathon program. And so Somi, if you just reach out and go to our staff page and reach out to Somi directly, she can hook you up.
Yep. So we had a question about relating to beavers, which I think is still beaver numbers throughout the state, which is a bit you probably don't have an answer to that particular question, but it reminded me of mammals and the mammals programs that you do have. Can you talk about some of the trips that involve mammals?
Oh, boy. Well, I mean, you know, they're so varied. I think when I think about our mammal trips, you know, again, we've had trips with amphibians and reptiles and, you know, you name it. I'm trying to think of, you know, specific trips that we've had, but certainly, you know, wolves. We've had wolf howling field trips. And like you mentioned earlier, we've had elk we've done elk and calf trips and I'm guessing in the past we've probably done small mammal trapping as well. I remember doing that back in my grad school days or prior to grad school even. But yeah, I think, you know, all taxa we pretty much cover with our field trip. So if folks are interested in getting out and learning more about mammals or reptiles or birds, we provide those opportunities for sure.
I want to move to the great Wisconsin Birdathon next, because that's starting up in a few weeks. And for those who aren't aware of it, and we've talked a bit about it on the show for sure, but what's it all about?
Yeah, well, the Great Wisconsin Birdathon, again, Barbarzin was kind of behind this. You know, we have the Bird Protection Fund, which is a fund that provides funding for rare, declining, or endangered birds. And the Birdathon was really a mechanism for providing dollars to put on the ground for bird conservation. So really, it's one, a fundraiser. It's sort of like, you know, I grew up in the American Heart Association had this jump-a-thon or jump-rope-a-thon when I was a kid. It's kind of the same thing, right, where you go around and you get pledges for, you know, how long, in my case, how long I'm going to jump rope for, and they pledge like 20 cents per minute or whatever it was. It's kind of the same thing with Birdathon. So it's how many birds you're going to see within a 24-hour period of time, and you get sort of pledges, and people will say, well, I'll give you $1 for every bird or $5 for every bird you see within that 24-hour period of time. So it's a fundraiser for birds, but also, you know, what we've learned, I think, over the years in doing this is it's just fun. It's just, you know, individuals can do this. You can form teams. You know, church groups and school groups and other nonprofits, you know, can form teams. And, you know, it's kind of a competition of how many birds they're going to see. And ultimately, you know, how much money can be raised, but that money goes back out to bird conservation here in the state of Wisconsin.
How many species do you know off the top? How many species of birds have been recorded over the years?
Boy, 275-ish, I think.
That's pretty good.
It's pretty good, yeah. It's a pretty good number.
I'm forgetting how many bird species we have in Wisconsin, but 275 would be.
Yeah, I think that's cumulative, probably.
Yeah. Over time.
Yeah.
Well, and the other thing was just sort of an aside. I love the names of some of the groups.
Yeah, they're great. Yeah,
people come up with some of the most creative names for their birding group.
Yeah, no, they're so creative. I can't even think of any right now.
I know. know it. As soon as I opened my mouth, I thought, oh, no, now I'm not going to remember a single one.
I should have had a list of those because they are incredibly creative. Yeah, they're hilarious.
You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you can email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to Vivian in Green Bay. Vivian, hi. Thank you for calling.
I may be the biggest advocate that you have out here. I tell people about the more than 20 years I've been a member. My late husband and I joined probably during the second or third year. Wow. I remember brochures coming out that listed 16 trips.
Yeah.
And look where we are now.
Indeed.
We attended the 25th anniversary celebration in Baraboo years ago, and each came home with a little keepsake brass crane. I haven't done as many since my husband passed away 23 years ago. But when I talk to people about exposing their children to the out of doors, mm-hmm. I just say it's easy. Wisconservation.org.
Thank you, Vivian. That's wonderful. No, I appreciate that. And, you know, even when I started with the foundation initially in 2004, we were running about 49 field trips at that time. And I left in 2010 to serve as ED for Driftless Land Trust, Land Conservancy, and came back then in 2019, and we were running 270 plus field trips. So Christine and Kim have done a wonderful job. And it's not just the numbers, but the quality of the trips, I think, are what's so wonderful about the program is they've been so thoughtful, and we've had we've been so fortunate to engage such wonderful field trip leaders. And so I appreciate that, though. Thank you for for your support because frankly, we're a member organization, and your support helps us do the important work that we do as a foundation. Ultimately, you know, we are raising money to support the lands, waters, and wildlife here in Wisconsin, and to support environmental education, and to really engage a diverse community of people throughout the state. So that's what member support helps us with. Thank you.
Let's go to Pat in McHenry, Illinois next. Hi, Pat. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Oh, you're very welcome. This is a wonderful program. I'm wondering a couple of things. One is we have a grandson who is 5 years old, loves the outdoors. So how is he too young to possibly participate in any of these trips or other programs?
Yeah, not at all. But what I would recommend is that you identify the family-friendly field trips. For instance, I took my kids to kestrel banding last year, to saw white owl banding last year, and also mussels of the Mequonago last year. And, you know, my son brought his snorkel and, you know, got in the water and was underwater looking for mussels. And so there are kids of all ages on any of these field trips. You know, there are going to be field trips that are geared more toward adults. So I would say, you know, try to focus on the family friendly field trips because those tend to be geared toward kids and families.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And aside from the bandings, can you think off the top of your head of other family friendly ones?
Oh, well, this is where we need our subject experts, Christine and Kim. But I'm just looking at some of these here. I mean, even things like, though I think it's geared a little bit more toward ecology and sort of understanding ecosystems, but that train ride through the Tiffany Bottoms is a lot of fun just because kids get on this little train on little tracks and you go into this into the Tiffany Bottoms wildlife area, and you know that's pretty special just as an experience. But there's a there are a number too of even I think it's kind of cool where DNR has led some trips for us, for instance, just doing shocking of brook trout as part of a brook trout study, and you get to see these fish and animals up close, which I think is really special. And And anything, any sort of bird banding, I think is fantastic for kids because often kids are able to hold passerines in hand and let them go. And, you know, that's always pretty special too.
Pat, does that help you out?
Yes, it does. It's wonderful information. And if we have time, I have one more quick question.
Sure.
Okay, and that is, can people from Illinois join your foundation?
No, I'm sorry. No, I'm kidding. Yes, of course you can. Pat, I'm from Illinois originally, too, so no worries. Yeah, no, the more the merrier. Yes, we'd love to have you as a member.
And if you go to the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin?
Yeah, wisconservation.org, and there's a donate button on the front page, and easy peasy.
Yeah.
Yep.
Pat, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, man, it's great to hear from callers. And volunteer opportunities. I imagine there are some with the Natural Resources Foundation.
Yeah. In fact, all of our field trip leaders are volunteers. You know, so we would not be able to run this field trip program without, you know, all these volunteers, this network of volunteers that Christine and Kim have developed over the years. We also have, you know, volunteer opportunities in-house. You know, just we are a nonprofit, so nonprofits are always benefit from volunteerism. You know, our Wayfarers group is a group of volunteers, our committees. We have committee members that are volunteers, you know, for different programs that we run. Ample opportunity, ample opportunity.
And the grant program, you've got this grant program. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, we have, you know, as a foundation, right, we have our programmatic arm. We do have permanent endowments. So we hold endowments. These are permanently restricted funds that distribute, you know, the revenue that we gain each year. Off those investments, we put that back on the ground. But we are a grantor and a grantee as well, right? So we're writing grant proposals to other private foundations, national foundations to bring money into the state of Wisconsin. But we also give money out as a grantor. And one of our programs is the Bisadne Small Grants Program. And that's we've had that program going now for a number of years. And the Bisadne Small Grants Program, you know, has supported environmental education efforts and conservation efforts in every county in the state over the years. And it was, you know, started to honor Buzz Bisadne, the former secretary of the Wisconsin DNR. And that committee is really a board committee and staff committee. We do have some outside volunteers that serve on that committee as well. But you know, that committee is really in the Bisadne Small Grants work has really supported a lot of environmental education work. That's been one of the big things. Nature centers as well. And really, you know, they tend to be small grants, so they're about $2,000 per grant. So I think the organizations that have leveraged those dollars over the years are really looking at either funds to, you know, start off a project or maybe end a project to clean up a project. But land trusts also have secured dollars through Bisadne for a number of different projects.
Yeah. Interviewed Buzz many times over the course of his tenure as DNR secretary. Yeah. It's nice to have something like this in his honor or named for him. Kellen Sugar Camp, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Maybe more than 50 years ago, I was in the Janesville school system, which was fabulous back then. And they took us, when we were very young, out to see like an Indian mound. They took us out to see like a woods. I mean, it's very important to get children when they're young. I went into science because of that. And you've got to get them when they're 8 or 9 years old so they're not afraid to go out in the woods or walk along in a prairie place where it's, you know, where there's a trail, someplace that Wisconsin probably owns, something close. Inner city kids have no idea what it's like for a walk in the woods. They have no idea.
Yeah, I think that's why I'm so excited about you know, the prospects of our building out our family-friendly trips because, yeah, engaging youth is where it's at, in my mind. You know, that's when you do build that ethic and, you know, you kind of imprint nature on kids. And so, you know, part of our mission, too, is to engage all people in the natural world. And so we're looking at everything from, you know, urban ecology and what's happening in cities to what's happening in, you know, old growth forests in the north and everything in between. So, yeah, totally agree with you. And I appreciate the good thought and comment.
Thank you very much, Kel. Appreciate it. And David, thank you so much. Boy, it's
been a pleasure.
Always fun to I'm always amazed at the number and quality of experiences that the foundation puts together. It's wonderful, and I hope you fill everyone.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity to talk with folks. Thank you, Larry.
David Clatter is Executive Director of the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin. Take a look at their website and join up and get your hands on those trip catalogs. And, you know, it's probably these can fill up just off. They can fill up. So.
They can fill up fast. Yeah. And folks should watch out for this. So with the field trips, we will fill 70% of field trips on day one. So signups are going to be early April. So, you know, reach out right away. Birdathon registration starts March 15th, and then those trips run, or Birdathon runs from April 15th through June 15th. So those are coming right up. So definitely get on it.
Yeah, absolutely. David Clatter, Executive Director of the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin. Coming up, we're going to take a look at our water here in the state, how you and I can maybe help save some of that water. There are a lot of things that we can do to maybe cut our own water bills, but at the same time, save water for the next generations to come. That's next. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network.
Free tickets are available now to attend the final Forte of the Bolts Young Artist Competition. Join WPR's Lori Skelton along with the Madison Symphony Orchestra, conducted by John Demain, on Wednesday, March 6th. WPR is proud to support classical musicians of all ages. Make a free reservation today at madisonsymphony.org.
You're listening to The Ideas Network from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Israel's main advocacy group against sexual assault has compiled a report about sexual violence in the Hamas attack on Israel October 7th. And United Nations experts are calling for an investigation into accounts of Israeli abuses against Palestinian women. A warning, this report contains graphic details. NPR's Daniel Estrin has more from Tel Aviv.
Israel's Association of Rape Crisis Centers has submitted a report to the United Nations on sexual violence committed by Hamas at a music festival, in kibbutz communities, and in Israeli military bases. It says it gathered confidential information from officials and testimonies from first responders and found a, quote, systematic, targeted pattern of abuse, assaulting women in front of family and friends before killing them, genital mutilation, and inserting weapons inside victims' genitals. And UN Human Rights Council experts are calling for an independent investigation into what they term credible allegations of Israeli soldiers assaulting Palestinian women and girls in Gaza. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Russian state media report the mother of the late Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny is now suing to get her son's remains released to her. Russian prison officials say Navalny died last week but have not released exact cause of death. At a town hall last night, former president and 2024 candidate Donald Trump drew comparisons between himself and Navalny. Here's NPR's Stephen Fowler.
Trump faces multiple court cases across multiple jurisdictions, including a civil fraud trial in New York where a judge found Trump lied about his wealth. In a South Carolina town hall with Fox News' Laura Ingraham, Trump compared his situation to the late Russian dissident Alexei Navalny.
It is a form of communism or fascism.
Trump also said his cases, including two stemming from failed efforts to overturn the 2020 election, were political persecution, though sidestepped a question asking if he viewed himself a political prisoner. Stephen Fowler, NPR News, Atlanta.
A privately owned robotic probe is on track to attempt a lunar landing tomorrow. Here's NPR's Jeff Brumfield.
The probe, known as Odysseus, is circling just over 50 miles above the lunar surface. On board are several experiments for NASA, as well as some commercial payloads, including fabric from a big sportswear manufacturer. Its selected landing site is near the lunar South Pole, a place that may have water in the form of ice. Getting to the moon is one thing. Landing on the moon is quite another. Jonathan McDowell is with the Smithsonian Observatory.
Lunar landings are not trivial. It's not that easy.
Probes from Russia, Japan, Israel, and India have all tried to land on the moon, but cratered instead. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
The Dow is down 110 points. You're listening to NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 12:04. I'm Alex Crowe. The Wisconsin Assembly approved a bill yesterday that would withhold state funds for homeless services unless they meet certain benchmarks. It would also impose a criminal penalty on people who sleep outside on public property unless it's been designated as a temporary campground. Representative Alex Dahlman, a Republican of Green Lake, said the plan would move homeless people into safer places and increase accountability for public dollars.
There's nothing more inhumane than allowing a population of homeless individuals to live on our streets and on our sidewalks, on the front steps of our businesses.
Democrats blasted the bill as cruel, saying it criminalizes homelessness. The proposal is based on model legislation written by a Texas think tank. A Republican prosecutor is asking the Wisconsin Supreme Court to decide whether state law bans abortions before the case goes through any lower appellate courts. The U.S. Supreme Court's 2022 decision to overturn Roe v. Wade reactivated an 1849 law that conservatives argue banned abortion. A Dane County judge said last summer that the legal language in the ban does not use the term abortion, so the law only prohibits attacking a woman in an attempt to kill her unborn child. Sheboygan County District Attorney Joel Ermansky is appealing that ruling. He filed a petition on Tuesday asking the state Supreme Court to take up the case without waiting for a decision from a lower appellate court. More news at WPR.org. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
Whether you laugh along with Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, or feed your mind with To the Best of Our Knowledge, you'll always find something to enjoy on Wisconsin Public Radio. Find our program schedule and listen online at WPR.org.
Taking a look at saving water at your home today, and mine as well. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today. Lucky to have Adam Freihofer with us. He's the Water Use Section Manager in the Bureau of Drinking Water and Groundwater at the Department of Natural Resources. So, questions about how towns and cities manage water? Wondering how you should change your water use during, maybe even during a drought? Or maybe have some ideas about how you already save water? Number to call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And just before we broke for news, we had a caller, Adam, who wondered about nitrate contamination and what can be done about it or what is being done about it in terms of maybe as it relates to our drinking water.
Yeah, thanks, Larry. That's obviously a topic that's across the state, and the central part of the state has faced it more so, and particularly because of the sandy soils that exist in the central sands part of the state. What I would say, it's a bit of a balancing act of budgeting. So the idea with agriculture there is to get fertilizers on the ground to keep the crop yields up, but not to have more than you want leaching into that groundwater. So that becomes not only a nutrient question, also becomes a water question, a water conservation question. You want to keep track of how much you're applying to those fields and not apply too much. And one of the things that, you know, to that end, that the potato and vegetable growers and UW took on with our support at DNR a couple of years ago was looking at instrumenting fields to watch when the plants shut down. To the naked eye, they look like they're still growing and would need water, but they're not evaporating any more water. They're basically shutting down for the season. And rather than keep applying water and leaching things like nitrate into the ground, they wouldn't be applying that water. It's a conserving mechanism, but it's also a water quality improvement situation as well. So there are things that go on both the conservation side that can also improve the water quality too.
Dan in Hartford called, couldn't stay with us, but wondering, is it necessary to rinse your jars and your cans for recycling? It seems like a waste of water to Dan.
That's going to be a question for the individual companies that take that on. So all recycling and those facilities sometimes have specific rules about what you can and cannot put in the recycling bin. So I don't want to speak to any more than that. But I do it as well. But it's a really good question.
Bruce in Dover, we'll go to you now. Hi, Bruce.
Hey. You're a great guy. I've been listening to you for years.
Thanks, Bruce.
Don't retire. You're one of my favorite voices. We lost so many. Mm. They retired. My question for Adam is, when the municipal water goes back into service, are you testing for conductivity at all? The old standard 40 years ago used to be 40 micromoles of conductivity. Since then, I'm sure Yellow Springs Instruments, who is the only provider of detection devices for this, has slimmed it down quite a bit more. Could you help me understand that a little better, Adam?
Yeah, thanks, Bruce.
Well, yeah, thanks for the question. I think in terms of municipal water use, the municipalities do a huge suite of testing for their water supply to meet Safe Water Drinking Act requirements. Beyond that, in terms of the instrumentation, I can't really speak to what they're exactly using. I think some of the municipalities would be better suited for that. So I don't want to speculate as to what exactly they're using for their testing. But they are required to meet Safe Water Drinking Act requirements.
Yeah. Janice in Shiocton, on to you now. Hi, Janice.
Hi. I love your program. I live north of Shiocton on the banks of the Wolf River. I have my own well and septic system with a drain field. My concern with this drought and now what you're telling me about nitrates in the rivers, how often should I have my well tested?
All right. So groundwater, she's got a well. How often should anybody for that matter, with a well, have their water tested?
it's not a bad idea to test it at least annually. So, you know, I mean, your private well owners are kind of their own utility operator in some respects. So it's a good idea to know what's in that water. And an annual test lets you know if things have changed and if you need to account for those things in your well, whether it's, you know, making sure the well is functioning right, making sure the pump's in the right location. You know, you talked about drought, and sometimes the water levels, the groundwater levels will drop during a drought. So you want to make sure you're not high and dry. So having your well inspected and tested annually is not a bad idea.
All right. Do we know, we have a pretty good idea of the amount. I mean, there are a lot of wells in this state. Do we know how much water comes out of those wells every year?
Well, we do. We know how much comes out of the high capacity wells because we are able to track that through water use reporting. That's required for larger withdrawals. And by larger withdrawals, any well that has the capacity to pull 100,000 gallons per day is what we're able to track. So that's part of that 1.9 trillion gallons of water that's used every year. We're able to track that. Now there's hundreds of thousands of private wells that the last caller just mentioned that don't need to report their water use to us, that we aren't tracking, you know, residential wells, basically. Those take out a very small amount of water, but it is their water supply, their lone water supply. So obviously equally as important as municipal water supply to them.
Doug in Richfield, we'll go to you now. Hi, Doug.
Hi. An earlier caller said that he captures the condensate from his natural gas furnace, and I believe he actually said that he drinks it and uses it for plants. He should be aware that that is a condensed natural gas, and it's from your flue, and it's very acidic. I mean, I'm watching it in my house slowly eat concrete away. He should check with his service guys or somebody that I think it's a practice that he should stop.
All right, Doug, thanks. Adam, comment?
Yeah, I agree that you should, if you're reusing water, you should know what that source of that water and what that water quality is. That's, you know, kind of where the rain barrel idea comes in. You know, you're capturing water off of your rooftop and through the gutter, and that's fine to apply to, you know, plants that need it in your yard, trees and stuff, particularly, you know, when we have drought periods. That's the banking system, if you will. So knowing the water source and what you're using it for are big pieces of that water reuse component.
Thank you, Doug. Appreciate it. Francis emailed to say, it's important to make people aware of how much water is truly used in a reverse osmosis water filtration home system. She believes it's at least 2-to-1 ratio of two parts used in processing and only one part for consumption. And I think that's right, but I'm not positive.
Yeah, I can't speak to the exact mechanisms in terms of the use on the RO systems. I can tell you that when we look at a water coming into a house, whether it's from a well or from a municipality, and we look at the water budget, the checkbook of where all that water goes, that the majority of it does not go to drinking water. You know, something like an RO system might treat. Usually RO is focused on the drinking water side of things. The majority of that water is going towards toilets, showers, washing machines. That's where a lot of your water is going. So when we look at the impact on total water use and the role in everyone's home, it's usually those types of things and not the drinking water. The drinking water is about only 1% of your total checkbook of your house's water use, which is a tiny amount. But it's obviously an important amount, but a tiny.
Oh. And I saw your DNR had a note on, or some photos or diagrams, I should say, if you've got a drip in your faucet, 10 drips, shower taking looking at 10 drips will equal about 500 gallons a year of water. That's amazing.
It adds up, and it's the long game, right? So you think every time you run your wash machine or your dishwasher, and if you have an inefficient model, an old toilet, let's say, every time you're running it, it adds up. Or if your toilet has a leak in it, as time goes, it might not matter that much that day, but as time goes on, it adds up to a significant amount of water, which you, as a ratepayer, if you're a municipality, are paying for. So you want to, it's again, it comes back to preserving the system, the ecosystem and the aquifers, but also comes back to your checkbook and not having to pay for water you don't necessarily need or inefficient use of it.
Stephen Adams County, excuse me, Stephen Adams County would like to know how aquifers get refilled.
Great question. So aquifers are, it really comes back to, again, we'll look at that checkbook analogy I was using in the beginning. So when it rains, a percentage of that rain is going to recharge into the ground. It's going to soak into the ground and infiltrate in and reach the water table, the top of the groundwater level in those aquifers. And how much, really depends on precipitation events, depends on the soil. So if we have really clay soils like we do in some parts of the state, we won't see possibly a lot of recharge. More of it will run off into our rivers and streams. If we're in the central sands part of the state where it's very sandy, we may have less runoff and more infiltration of that rainwater into the ground. So we just came off of a record high precipitation period in the late 2010s, and our aquifers filled up. We had so much precipitation in 2018, 2019. We were dealing with the fact that the water table was is reaching the land surface. We were having groundwater flooding. And I know, Larry, you talked about that in a previous episode
a couple of days ago.
And so this is something, that's where you see too much. The checkbook is overflowing. During droughts, we see the opposite, where we're not getting as much of that precipitation and the water level is starting to fall, and the aquifers are starting to fall. And we saw that last year. After all the record precipitation last year, we had a flash drought. It came on really fast, and it was pretty hard that July, August, September period, and we saw water levels really come down. And so that's part of the climate change discussion of where we're going from really highs to real lows in a hurry and adapting to that. And so that's ultimately, we do a lot of, DNR does a lot of work with us and our partners of monitoring the groundwater levels to evaluate how much of that water is going back into the ground every year and what's it mean for the sustainability of our aquifers across the state of Wisconsin.
Mike in Beaver Dam, we go to you. Hi, Mike.
Hi, I just got a comment on saving water. I got the older porcelain toilet, and what I did, and it's been in there for 30 years, is I just fill up a 2-liter bottle with sand and set it right in the tank. And then I got it out of the Navy 38 years ago, and I still take the old Navy shower instead of a Hollywood shower.
Mike, thanks for calling. Good tips there, Adam?
Yeah, absolutely. I think with the toilets, too, there's a quick test that homeowners can, especially with older toilets, can check. They can put a couple of take a clean toilet, put a couple of drops of dye or food coloring into the tank and wait 10 minutes and see if it shows up in the bowl. And if it shows up in the bowl, you have a leak. And so that's usually a pretty simple fix. It's usually the toilet flapper that needs to be corrected. And it's an easy thing that homeowners can do. Obviously, you want to flush that water, that food coloring or dye down once you're done with it so you don't stain the bowl. But it's something easy that homeowners can do. Each one of these toilets over time uses a certain gallon of water, and they've gotten a lot better over time. They've been engineered to use less water but still do the job. So, as homes are replacing things, by default, they're usually getting toilets that are more water efficient. Certainly the thing to look for on appliances and things like toilets are the EPA's water sense label. And that's just indicating that that fixture, that toilet is going to be more water efficient, save you money over the long run, as you go. So there, EPA has done a great job of really promoting this nationwide.
Stella in Sturgeon Bay, hello, what's on your mind? Oh, we lost Stella. Ron in La Crosse, Ron called back to say he does not drink the water from his furnace. So there we've got that. Well, let's talk some more about actually saving here. If you want to save, somebody wants to save water at home, what are a few easy things they can do to start?
Sure. Well, depending on the age of your home, that's going to be, the first question. If you have an older home, just as things wear out, whether it's a dishwasher that stops working, you need to get a new one, or a washing machine, replacing it with these more water-efficient, energy-efficient fixtures, appliances can save you a lot of money. Like we said, the bathroom is one of the bigger water users, the faucets, the shower, the toilets. So as things have to be replaced, getting those water-efficient fixtures, that can save 20% across the home. The other thing to think about is the lawn, the outside. We are typically Mother Nature takes care of a lot of the watering we need, but other times we have to, folks like to water their grass and make sure it stays green over the course of the summer. We certainly saw this last year across a lot of the state with that drought. Watering early in the morning, less frequently. So you don't need to water every day. If you water once, for a longer period of time, that ends up saving you water, and it's equally or better that for the lawn to do it that way. Keeping your grass longer, letting it grow a little, so that promotes better rooting of your grass. Retaining soil moisture by putting compost or bark around trees and shrubs, that's another thing. Planting, putting plants that are better suited for the variability of our precipitation, especially as we try to navigate climate change. So prairie grasses, which look really nice in yards, that's one option you could do, is replace some of that lawn with native grasses and things like that. So outside you can save, and obviously we are not the desert Southwest. We're not facing those type of issues. But in Wisconsin, we do tend to use more water in the summer, and that's really because of our outdoor water use. Indoors, you can conserve, like I said, a lot depending on the fixtures, the replacement of that. I think, as the caller noted, doing common sense things like possibly taking a quicker shower or not running the water while you're brushing your teeth. These are small little things that we don't often think about, but they all add up in the long run. If you make those changes, they add up over a bigger time period.
Scraping plates instead of rinsing them before putting them in the dishwasher. That's another one. And a lot of the dishwashers today are much more efficient than the older ones from years back. And you're using less water if you use a dishwasher.
Yes. Yeah, the dishwashers now are very efficient in terms of their water use. And the other thing, Larry, to mention on this discussion of water conservation in the home is one that I hadn't really thought about all that much until I started diving into this more, is that our water footprint. We turn on the tap, we get the water, we see that. But it's the things we don't see that also have an impact. It's the things that in our house that require water, require energy to be manufactured or be used. So replacing light bulbs with more energy efficient ones. As we talked about, power plants use a third, three quarters of our water.
Yeah.
So less power is less water use. So, there's things you can do in your home that don't seem necessarily intuitive, but they do add up to water savings.
And the DNR website I thought was pretty cool on water use and so forth. And people should go to the Wisconsin DNR website and I forget exactly, is it water, just water use or something?
Yeah, if you either Google Wisconsin DNR water use, that'll take you to our water use page, which includes really nice interactive tools that show how water is used across the state, but it also has our water conservation page that talks about tips and tricks for indoor and outdoor water conservation. There's also links on that page to EPA's website, some water calculator tools, things that DNR uses quite a bit in our establishment of implementing water conservation across the state.
Adam, it's a pleasure talking with you today. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us. I really appreciate it, and I hope we do this again.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Adam Freihofer, our guest today. He is the Water Use Section Manager in the Bureau of Drinking Water and Groundwater at the Wisconsin DNR. Great to have him with us. Looking at tomorrow's program, it's our guide to everything you need to know before a trip to the Boundary Waters. Plus, we get a visit from the author of the book Gunflint Falling, Blow Down in the Boundary Waters. That's tomorrow at 11 on The Larry Mueller Show. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store. I'm Larry Mueller.